morning. 962.
Report on recent work from the city auditor, police training follow-up, Bureau of Environmental Services stormwater requirements, short-term rental regulation.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. Mayor in absentia. I am City Auditor Mary Hall Caballero. I'm here today to share results of our latest audits and introduce brief presentations by the staff who led them. We began delivering audit results to City Council on a quarterly basis about a year ago. Our hope was that these appearances would be taken in the spirit in which we intend them, which is for the city to become more effective, efficient, and equitable. We hope to use these opportunities to speak to you as a group, to highlight themes across audits that can apply to any operations and programs, whether they are the subject of an audit we are presenting on any given day. I appreciate your attention to our findings and recommendations and for the spirited discussion that sometimes follows our presentations. Performance audits are independent, methodical assessments of how well management is implementing the policies and programs established by this body. We choose topics based on a variety of factors, such as indications that a bureau or program is in danger of not achieving its goals, or the level of taxpayer funding invested in them. Most important, we want our audits to be timely and reliable sources of information for the public, council, and city managers. Today, I'm introducing three recent reports. The first highlights the Police Bureau's progress on recommendations we made in a 2015 audit of the Training Division. The second focuses on two programs managed by the Bureau of Environmental Services to prevent sewer and stormwater from damaging property or ending up in our waterways. And the third is an assessment of the city's regulation of short-term rental market and its effect on the housing crisis. And we'll begin with the police training follow-up.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Martha Prince. I'm a senior management auditor, and I led our June 2018 audit of police training, which was a follow-up audit. In a follow-up audit, we revisit recommendations made in the original audit. In this case, the original audit was released in March of 2015 and had 12 recommendations. Gaining and maintaining the public's trust is more likely when officers do their jobs as they should. And training helps officers keep up with the rapid pace of changes in societal, legal, and policy expectations. The 2015 audit found improvements had already been made to training since the 2012 U.S. Department of Justice report on the Police Bureau, which included a number of training-related recommendations. In this 2018 audit, we found that 5 of our 12 2015 recommendations had been implemented. 6 were considered in process, and 1 was no longer relevant due to an operational change made by the Police Bureau. They're grouped in this slide by topic area. In the interest of time, I won't go through each recommendation individually, but the comments I'll make in the next several slides are grouped according to the themes shown on this slide. It's important for police agencies to know their officers receive required training. Our 2015 audit found problems with some aspects of how Portland Police tracks officer training. The Bureau got a new database in January of this year. They're still working out some kinks with it, but we found the new system had better search capabilities than the old system. It also has a robust reminder system if an officer is found to be missing a required training, as well as other improvements. At the time of our audit, the Bureau was figuring out workarounds for the unresolved issues. It's also important that the Police Bureau know what types of training officers need, and after training is delivered, the Bureau needs to evaluate how well that training actually worked. The Police Bureau had just begun doing formal needs assessments when we did our 2015 audit and is now completing an assessment each year. The assessments draw upon a variety of sources and have been improving over time. The Bureau is also doing more and better evaluations than they were in 2015. This Police Bureau graphic shows some of the inputs and outputs in their needs assessment and evaluation process. Although the Bureau is doing more evaluation than in the past, they aren't yet doing as much as we said they should in the 2015 audit. The Police Bureau also still needs to work on how to communicate with the chief about training effectiveness. Police training programs should address important topics thoroughly and consistently. In 2015, we recommended the Bureau provide more scenario-based training as opposed to classroom-based training, and you've got a photo there of the scenario village, and that they more consistently cover such topics as confrontation management, dealing with mental health crises, the need for officers to get medical help for subjects when needed, and not using profanity. In 2018, we found a lot of variability from year to year in the hours of scenario-based training the Bureau offered since the time of our original audit, as you can see in the chart on the slide. The Bureau also didn't use actual cases as part of training for tenured officers as much as they could have. In 2018, we found that officers were receiving more training on the need to get medical help than they had been in 2015, but needed additional training on not using profane or demeaning language. In 2015, we found the Bureau's three precincts had inconsistent procedures for checking out weapons. We also found that officers didn't always include weapons information when they logged into the Bureau's dispatch system, which they were required to do. The Bureau now has consistent and more thorough procedures for checking out weapons. Those procedures include directing supervisors to conduct an inventory of the armory during each shift and to make sure officers check out weapons properly. Finally, our 2015 audit recommended that the Bureau provide refresher training on how to store ammunition for less lethal weapons to avoid repeating an incident in which an officer accidentally loaded live ammunition into a less lethal shotgun, which resulted in an injury. That's no longer possible because the Bureau changed to a different less lethal launcher, which can't be loaded with live ammunition. And that concludes my presentation, and I would be happy to take any questions you may have.
Okay, thank you. Questions?
Thank you. This is a very helpful update, and I'm really pleased to see the improvements that have been made under Chief Outlaw. I think the audit confirms that we are making progress, and just that graphic you just showed does. What kind of training do they do on the issue of profanity and language?
One of the things that we saw and why we did not consider it to be totally implemented is they're saying it's woven into a lot of different trainings, but I reviewed all kinds of lesson plans and other similar materials, and I didn't find as much as we thought there should have been, and also we wanted to see, you know, very specific trainings. We also found that there was more of that type of training in the initial training that officers would receive, but it didn't seem to be as much in the ongoing, you know, the in-service training for the tenured officers. So we just wanted to see more about that.
Yeah, I wonder if they knew what proportion of the complaints to independent police review are related to profanity, if that would be helpful.
And they did talk about their impression that that the complaints were often more about respect and not specifically profanity. I mean, you know, demeaning language, obviously
right.
there's you know, a lot of variability in how you look at that, but that it was kind of part of their procedural justice work that they're doing. But, you know, just in short, we just wanted to see more very specific talk about that, and so that's why we considered it in process.
And how often do they receive training on de-escalation?
I don't know off the top of my head, and I don't recall if it's on a specific schedule.
So I appreciated you highlighting the new tracking system, which will make it easier to check.
Right.
Are they required to take kind of refresher courses on a regular basis?
Yeah, there's a lot of training. You know, it's ongoing, and one reason, one hope for the new system was that they'll just keep better track of, because a lot of the a good portion of the training is delivered via video. It's
yeah.
not always going for the 2 days of in-service training that we might think of. So it sort of pings you continually. At the officer level, if you didn't take it, and then it goes up the chain of command.
Yeah.
So I think they like that sort of automate. You know, it can go all the way up to the chief, actually. So just to really make sure everybody's doing all the different trainings that they're required to do.
I'm glad we have that. When I worked at OHSU, every year you had to watch 5 videos, electrical
right.
safety, fire safety. And every year I'd be like, oh, I've already seen this 15 times.
Right.
Every year I'd be like, oh, that's new.
Exactly.
Yeah, so that,
exactly.
And it was very helpful to have those automatic reminders to, you know,
right.
you haven't done this.
Right.
Great.
Right. And they want to keep things fresh in the officers' minds.
Yeah, that's yeah. very positive. Thank
yeah.
you.
You're welcome.
Are there any standards for scenario-based training in terms of how many hours a year an officer should have?
No, they didn't have a goal they weren't entirely sure why they had had that variability. I think they do want to do more. They talked about, you know, it takes a lot of planning, it takes a lot of time, and the other thing they mentioned, of course, there are always new requirements, and it's been an intensive time as far, you know, this audit being concurrent to the DOJ settlement. So I think they just expressed that they would like to do more.
Okay.
So how do they manage that? As you say, the policies have been changing. What strategies do they use to make sure that their staff know what the latest changes are? Because I get the police directive and there are dozens of them.
Well, I mean, I guess I would just say they did talk to me about the fact that it's challenging and that it's so fluid. And I think that's one reason why the audit basically says, you know, it's improving, there's still work to be done. It's one of the most dynamic areas of the police bureau, I think, as far as, you know, people tend to look to training as being very important. Of course, there are other things that they want to look at if things don't go as they wish they had, but it's a very high profile area. It gets a lot of attention.
So many changes, it seems like every month they should have an update of what's the most important things of the latest changes.
Right. And satisfying the DOJ and sort of ongoing, you know, a lot of back and forth, and then something else changes. So it's and, you know, they, in their opinion, they need more staff. We didn't comment on that, but just it is a very intensive area, or it has been the last couple of years for sure.
When did you finish your analysis work and move into the writing is up?
I don't have an exact date. I mean, the audit came out in, when did it come out? June. So usually there's at least a month when you're finalizing things, sometimes as much as 2 months. So I'd say roughly May.
Okay, so we did actually approve more training staff in this fiscal year budget, so
I'm
hopefully
sure
that addresses it. Thank
right,
you.
Right, you're welcome.
At least helps.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
So the next audit we want to discuss was our audit of private stormwater management. Do I need to move this closer?
My name is Elizabeth Pape, and I'm a senior management auditor, and I led our July 2018 audit of private stormwater management. This is the first in a series of two audits of BES stormwater management. We're still working with the Bureau and will release a second audit on management of green streets and restoration projects this fall. Stormwater is the rain that runs off hard urban surfaces like roofs and pavement. BES relies on private property owners to treat stormwater generated at their sites to prevent local flooding, system sewer backups, erosion, and pollution in natural waterways. This diagram shows how private structures prevent sewer overflows during heavy rain events. On sunny days and days with light rain, the system collects and treats all sewage and stormwater. On days with heavy rain, untreated mixed wastewater can flow into the river. But when stormwater is managed on private property, the system is less likely to overflow during heavy rains. There are a variety of types of structures property owners can use to manage stormwater. Eco roofs collect rainwater to reduce runoff. Dry wells collect runoff below the ground and allow it to disperse into the ground. Planters collect runoff above the ground, filter it, and can allow it to disperse into the ground. And swales collect runoff at the ground level, filter it, and can allow it to disperse into the ground. We looked at two of the Bureau's programs related to stormwater management on private property. The first was requirements associated with development contained in the Stormwater Management Manual. BES requires management for any development that increases impervious surface more than 500 square feet. The second program was the Clean River Rewards Program, which offers discounts for the on-site portion of the stormwater utility fee. These discounts can apply to ratepayers who operate the kind of structures required by the Stormwater Management Manual, and also similar structures retrofitted to existing properties, and not only those associated with new development. Our first finding was that data management systems were not adequate for the design of stormwater infrastructure. The calculations the city uses to decide on the size of pipes and the number of regional stormwater facilities requires knowledge of what structures are out there. Individual systems interact with regional facilities, and they need data on where facilities are located, how much stormwater they are designed to handle, and what conditions they're in. The Bureau relies on a variety of data collection methods for private structures that are not organized into a coherent system. Information is stored in three data systems, each managed by a separate group. Data collected involves a manual transaction between two systems, introducing the potential for data entry errors. One program relied on geographic information systems layer that did not include some participating accounts. And one program's information was not shared with system planners. In addition to issues with data management, the Bureau also did not have good information on the condition of private structures because it did not regularly inspect most of them. Of the total 37,000 properties, 6% were regularly inspected and 78% were never inspected, and most of these were single-family residential properties. The Bureau risked overspending by building higher capacity stormwater infrastructure because data systems could not account for the benefits provided by private stormwater management. Private structures can have significant impacts on budgets. For example, the Woodlawn King project budget decreased from $6.4 million to $2.2 million after including private structures. The Bureau used field researchers to compensate for incomplete data. To its credit, the Bureau's field research meant that the city incorporated information on private structures into project planning and did not build more pipes and system upgrades than needed. However, the process could have been faster and easier if information was available through well-managed data systems. Our recommendations to address these issues were to develop a single information system to inventory private stormwater structures and to develop additional risk-based monitoring programs. Our second finding was related to program evaluation. Since the Bureau adopted the permitting program almost 20 years ago and the Clean River Rewards program over 10 years ago, it has not gone back to assess whether the programs meet goals for stormwater management and rate fairness. Staff said they were unable to quantify the effects of private property structures on the entire system without investing a couple months of work. The Bureau did not have information on the cost of private stormwater structures, so we could not calculate costs associated with the permitting program. Adjusting thresholds could make the program more efficient. The Bureau's threshold for incorporating development into the program is at 500 square feet, which they said was one of the lowest in the country. This low permit threshold may have a high cost with little benefit for stormwater control. Increasing the threshold from 500 square feet to a more standard 1,500 square feet would reduce the number of permits by 8%, but decrease the area of impervious surface managed by less than 1%. Goals for rate fairness were also not evaluated. Most ratepayers who manage stormwater on-site do not participate in the Clean River Rewards program. The Bureau estimated that only 30,000 of 90,000 eligible properties participated. We calculated that 86% of properties with permitted structures were not participating, even though they should have been eligible.
Could you just explain to folks at home what is the Clean River Rewards program?
Sure. It's a program where, actually this one's better. You get a discount on the on-site portion of the stormwater fee, which is in this chart, that $9.60. So the ratepayers still pay the stormwater fee that applies to the entire system, but they don't have to pay the part that goes towards managing stormwater on site.
And the ratepayer has to apply for that discount, doesn't get it automatically.
That's correct. So these ratepayers, though, who had permitted stormwater structures but were not participating in the Clean River Rewards program, not only missed out on the $9.60 a month discount, but also paid $1.70 more each month to cover expenses not paid by those who did participate. So therefore, the majority of eligible ratepayers were worse off than they would be if the program did not exist. The Bureau's outreach efforts had a large impact on participation. Over half of participants enrolled in the program's first year when there was more extensive outreach. First year enrollment was over 16,000 accounts compared to around 1,500 accounts every year since then. Without evaluations, the Bureau could not prove that the benefits of private stormwater management exceeded costs imposed on the private sector and could not adjust program elements to optimize efficiency or effectiveness. Our recommendations to assess the performance of the Bureau's approach to encouraging private stormwater management were that the Bureau should create a schedule and assign staff to periodically evaluate outcomes of the permitting and Clean River Rewards programs against stated goals, and to use the results of evaluations to ensure the achievement of program goals and expectations. And that concludes this part. So if you have questions, we can answer them.
Thank you. Questions?
Why do you not recommend that they just automatically enroll people if they've got the permit?
We usually don't issue very specific recommendations and leave decisions like that up to management. But that's one of the things that I brought up with them. There might be some complications related to details in their data systems, so that was why.
I'm sure Commissioner Fish will be looking into it. It seemed like, although it says that there's an increased effect for paying for those who participate, if they've saved $4 million on having a smaller pipe, that's kind of a built-in, actually you've saved the ratepayers still, mm-hmm. even after paying for the discount. But as I say, I'm sure Commissioner Fish will look into it. Thank you.
I guess I had one question. So I want to make sure I heard that right. So yes, the Woodlawn King project, mm-hmm. decreased by $4 million when they went out and actually documented how much stormwater was being retained on site?
Yeah, so when they did the original project design, based on what information they had about assets within the system, they needed $6.6 million in improvements or something like that. Once they went out into the field and they looked at the actual structures in the neighborhoods, they found that a lot of the homes were actually connected to dry wells, and so they didn't have the needs they anticipated and reduced the project budget by $4 million.
That's pretty impressive. And then why do you think there are so few people enrolled in the Clean River discount program? Is it just lack of knowledge?
I think people don't know about it. There's not a lot of outreach, especially compared to the first year of enrollment. Most of the people who enrolled in those first years. Mm-hmm. I think people just don't know about it.
Okay. Yeah, do they have to keep re-enrolling?
You don't, but it's based on the ratepayer, not on the property. So if you're a tenant, and you'd have to enroll each time. So each new tenant would have to re-enroll for a property.
And if you bought a property, you wouldn't know that that was available to you necessarily.
You wouldn't necessarily know.
Thank you.
Thank you. One more.
Okay. Excuse me. Okay, so the next audit is on short-term regulation. My name is Alexandra Furchak, and I led this audit, which was released just last month. In this audit, we found that most short-term rental hosts do not have the required permits, and the city rarely enforces its regulation. And despite concerns about the effect of short-term rentals on housing availability and affordability, the city does not collect data needed to effectively regulate these rentals and to monitor the housing market. The city began regulating short-term rentals in 2014 when council changed the zoning code to allow residents to rent their homes for short terms. Now, the intent of the regulation was to preserve the residential character of neighborhoods and to prevent commercial short-term rental activity. But we found that the city's current regulation approach cannot assure this. Now, this graph shows that the market has more than doubled since 2015. Note that the largest growth is in the rentals of entire homes compared to private rooms within a home. I should also note here that in order to evaluate the regulation of short-term rental market, we had to obtain data from a third party because the city does not have this information. We presented an interactive version of this data on the city's auditor's website, so people can go on there and look at all the details. The regulations require each host to obtain a short-term rental permit and to follow certain restrictions. As of October 2017, Development Services issued over 1,600 active permits. However, during that time, there were over 4,600 rentals listed just on Airbnb alone. Adding the number of rentals from all the other booking agents that are operating in Portland, such as HomeAway or Vacasa, we estimate that only about 22% of rentals are actually permitted. One factor that has limited City's Bureau ability, as I mentioned earlier, is to enforce the regulation is the lack of data about short-term rental activity. And this includes addresses of rentals and also how often or for how long the listings are rented. Of the approximately 15 booking agents that are active in Portland, none provide data to the city. This map shows the rentals available in the city of Portland. And as you can see, it clearly shows some neighborhoods that have a higher concentration of these rentals. And as the number of these units has been increasing since 2014, their effect on housing market and neighborhood quality has not been monitored. No city bureau has officially been assigned the responsibility to monitor the impact on housing. And this map is broken out by neighborhoods where we account for short-term rental activity and also the number of housing units per neighborhood. As you can see, neighborhoods in Inner Northeast and also Inner Southeast are more frequented by renters than other parts of the city. These are also neighborhoods that have experienced historically gentrification and are facing affordable housing shortages. These neighborhoods should be monitored to determine how this market actually affects them. Data also shows that there are hosts with multiple short-term rentals. This map shows hosts with six or more rentals. But since the city doesn't have the information on these, such as addresses for the host and also their listings or rentals, it's not clear how much of this activity actually represents illegal renting. For example, some of these hosts are hotels or bed and breakfasts that are listed on the platforms. Some are separate rooms that people are listing in their houses. And some may be management companies that list units for their clients. But the main concern here is that these may be hosts listing multiple rentals that are not their primary residence, which would be a violation of city code. And because the city doesn't have access to the complete data on these listings, it cannot determine whether these renters are illegal or whether they are removing residences from the housing market, such as specifically the long-term rental market. So to effectively regulate the short-term rental, short-term rentals, we make a number of recommendations which are summarized here. They include obtaining complete data on active short-term rental hosts and their listings. And this data should either be obtained from the booking agents or from other publicly available sources. And the city should use it to proactively enforce the city's zoning and tax code. We also recommend revising the permitting and enforcement process to meet intended regulation goals. And to assess the impact of short-term rentals on the housing market, we recommend the Housing Bureau develop a monitoring process of this market in order to evaluate effects on city's housing and to report the results to City Council. And that concludes my presentation, so if you have any questions.
Thank you.
I have a few comments that I'd like to put on the record, and I welcome your brief feedback. I try not to use the Airbnb as like the jello or band-aid of short-term rentals because we know there's 10 or 15 platforms, but most of my dealings have been with Airbnb. And I will say that while the city has really tried to listen to and respond to their concerns and frustrations, especially those of the like legitimate small time hosts who are actually following our rules, I have not felt that Airbnb is bargaining with us in good faith. They've been dismissive of their impact on our rental market. They have refused every simple suggestion that we've put forth to exclude hosts who are not in compliance with our rules. And they're dragging their feet on giving us their host data. And it's one of the biggest frustrations and disappointments I had with BDS was that I wasn't able to advance enforcement. Because of that lack of data, it's difficult to impossible for us to prove that people are violating the owner-occupied home rule. And it would be extraordinarily expensive because it would basically be, I don't know, we're going to hire hundreds of private investigators to sit outside people's homes and see how often they're, you know, it's... However, the hosts with multiple listings seems like it would be very simple for Airbnb to eliminate. And in fact, they rolled out something called One Host, One Home. Is that the name? Yeah. Which was a pilot project where they supposedly eliminated all these multiple listings from hosts. But we know that that simply isn't the case. There's someone on Airbnb right now, I think, named Nadia, who is renting out 54 units in a high-rise apartment building in downtown Portland. I appreciate the audit, and even though this is no longer in my portfolio, it's something that I'm just going to continue to hammer on and pursue. And if they don't want to comply with our rules, they should get out of our city.
So once we know of a violator, then what happens?
I mean, I would need... Oh, I see the person I need right there in the back of the room. It doesn't look like he maybe wants to come up here, but Mike, would you be willing to come up and explain that process?
Hello.
And feel free to respond to anything I said as long as you entirely agree with me. No, just
of course, of course. Mike Liefeld, Bureau of Development Services. With respect to enforcement of accessory short-term rentals, we changed our enforcement response in, I want to say, 2017 or 2016 to move away from a compliance-based approach where we provided notice, a compliance period, and we found that just wasn't effective, and we needed to adopt a citation-based program, and so that is now receiving violations receive citations. The first citation is $1,000, second citation for repeated offense is $3,000, and then third offense and all other future offenses are at the $5,000 mark. In addition, if those simply are not working, become the cost of doing business, we still retain the right to proceed with a code hearing and seek up to $1,000 a day, which we have done successfully.
So in the instance that Commissioner Udaly pointed out with over 50 different units, is that $5,000 per unit or $5,000 per person doing the violation?
It could be. It's the admin rule states that it's, I believe, per violations. So it could be implemented on a unit-based approach, and it could be for each night. You know, in terms of trying to gain compliance and educate,
yeah,
we've found it to be effective.
Because if you've got 50, then $5,000
right,
over the 50
right,
is cost of doing business, as
and
you said.
If we reach the point where we've issued a second citation, our goal is to not do the administrative work, to just continue to issue citations. So our approach has been, upon issuing a second citation, we do increase the penalty. We let them know that while we do it per booking generally, we may move to a nightly offense, and then that would be $5,000 for each night. And so there are some tools at our disposal that allow us to get compliance.
I think at some point in the future it would be helpful to have a report from BDS about what kind of compliance enforcement you have. You know, because obviously it has previously been complaint-driven, and I know that there are community members who see this happening. I mean, yes, we can't afford to hire private investigators, but some of these rentals cause a lot of problems with late-night partying and basically becoming like a hotel and having similar problems. So then you get a complaint, then you investigate it. So obviously you have a new commissioner in charge with Mayor Wheeler, but it would be interesting to me to get a report on a summary report of over the last year, how many complaints, what the outcomes were, because that unless did was that looked into in the audit?
We did look at complaints, and the report also contains a map of where the complaints are actually originate. I mean, where the rentals that have been complained about.
But did you look at what happened in those complaints, whether they were enforced upon and
We did. We did look at the as far as tracking when the complaint was submitted, and then whether they were substantiated or not. Yeah.
And as to whether they've continued to do it or not. Or if they came into compliance?
Yes, we did look at that. Yes, yeah. Yeah, I don't have that information right now, but I can provide that.
I would be very interested to see that. Thank you. I mean, obviously, it's something we've been grappling with for several years, and until we get a handle on this, I think all other discussions about zoning code changes, accessory dwelling units, really should be pending getting this in line. Thank you both for your work.
And when did you move to the citation-based approach?
I believe I want to.
Was it like a year ago or?
It might have been it may have been December or February of 2017 or December of 2016. That's the time period that I'm recalling.
Yeah, I think it was finalized in January, February 2017. Yes. Yeah.
And have you found that so far that hosts that are cited initially are coming into compliance after their citation, or is it like Commissioner Fritz suggested, just a cost of doing business type of a thing?
We have fewer repeat violators. We do have properties that have received multiple citations and have allowed a lien balance to grow quite large. But overall, the citation-based approach is extremely effective. $1,000 for folks who were making the calculation that it was the cost of business quickly answers that question for them. They're not willing to engage in that risk-based approach, and that listing is taken down, and we're seeing that the property is being put into legal uses, more conventional 30-day rentals, or it's simply being sold because it's not a good investment property any longer.
Okay. And are rules about private homes, you have to live in the home, is it 6 months a year?
Nine.
Okay. So that's pretty alarming, I guess. There's so many private homes that are apparently not getting permitted at all. I mean, well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate, Auditor, you bring doing this periodically. I think it's important to bring your audits to us and summarize them and get our feedback.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I think it's really important to not have these audits as a report.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, I'm willing to let testimony. We have time this morning, for one thing.
Beautiful, thank you.
So how many people want to testify? Okay, we got three or four or five? Okay. So why don't you come up in a group of three, no more than three at a time, and I'll give you 3 minutes.
Thank you.
So you all know the drill. Give us your name for the record, and you each have 3 minutes.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. My name is Dan Handel, and I'm a member of Portland Cop Watch, and really appreciate the ability to testify on reports. We think it's very important, especially when it involves the police. This about the report on training, like many statements that have been coming from various parts of City Hall and the Bureau, it seems to imply the Bureau is doing just a great job, is almost done with the USDOJ settlement agreement. We would argue at this point, because it's been documented how many people who've been subjected to deadly force by the Bureau since the DOJ came to town were in mental health crisis. The underlying issues of racial profiling has not changed, nor any notable progress been made on collecting or analyzing the stop data as required by the agreement. It was alarming to read that the Bureau is not willing to use real-life Portland scenarios in training because they don't want to embarrass the officer involved who might be present at the training. This is outrageous if the Bureau is truly committed to learning from its mistakes. If the person who was involved recognizes they could have handled the situation better, there should be no embarrassment. This is not second grade. These are people who are trusting with guns and tasers and batons and pepper spray and flashbangs and a number of other weapons and tactics that cause considerable harm and trauma in our community. In the analysis of the needs assessment process, where the Bureau decides what kind of training is needed based on various factors, there's no mention of public input. This includes the Training Advisory Council, who has a meeting tonight, and I doubt that they were given a copy of this report ahead of time. They're specifically tasked in the DOJ agreement with helping to develop this assessment. The report says that officers are not consistently told to avoid profanity, demeaning language, and demeaning labels. There's training for new recruits in the Advanced Academy, but little in-service training, as you heard a little while ago. The Bureau claimed they weave the concept into other training and plan to do more about procedural justice and implicit bias in the future, but that just means they have plans and there's not really progress. It's also of interest that the auditor dropped an earlier recommendation that they talked about not loading shotguns with live rounds instead of less lethals because the PPB changed their less lethal systems. But we have seen, you know, of course, some of this happened after the report came out, but previously they were using flashbangs and other less lethal devices, which are very alarming and cause harm to people in the community. And there's no mention of them looking at the training for those new less lethal systems. They only said, oh, the old one is gone, so we don't have to continue making that recommendation anymore. We also asked, and you know, we sent you these comments on email yesterday. I hope you had, some of you had a chance to read them, but that the auditor's office also oversees independent police review, and their annual report came out in June of this year. It has been years since the last time an IPR report came before this council for your edification about what's going on with oversight and for the community to have input into what's going on with police accountability, and we would like the council to request the auditor to bring that IPR annual report before you. And we hope that that you will encourage the mayor, when he presides, to also allow testimony on reports, because it's not taking up much of your time. It's very helpful for our discussions. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
My name is Mimi Gurman. Thank you very much for allowing us to testify on this so-called report, which should not be a report, but a regular agenda item, and especially when it has to do with the police and an audit on what's going on with the police. The mayor ran on a platform of transparency for the police, not allowing us to testify on what's going on is a complete negation of part of what transparency is all about. So again, thank you for allowing this testimony. During the audit report, it was interesting to me that the police can't even figure out how to work their computer system. I know that there are kids in high school and perhaps middle school who could help them get a grip on their computer system. I'm fairly certain of that. So for that to be an acceptable piece of the review, that this is just okay, this is what's going on, after City Council either last year or the year before gave them money to revamp their system, thinking that maybe they could revamp their system. There was no oversight on who's gonna do that, apparently, because still a year or 2 years later, after having given them money, and Chloe's vote was a part of that, we are still seeing audits where they don't know how to work their machinery, their computers. It's unacceptable. Many of the things in the audit today are unacceptable, should be unacceptable to you, should be unacceptable to the mayor, should be unacceptable to the residents of Portland, when hearing that certain things that should be in compliance are still not in compliance, as the auditor's report told us today. That there are certain things pending, there are certain things that haven't gone through, certain things that they've just waved off, certain things, that they still haven't figured out how to tell the chief what's going on. That was in the report today with reference to certain aspects of the audit. It's all in that report. They can't figure out how to tell the chief certain things. That is unacceptable. That the chief is supposedly the one who is supposed to know what's going on, but her, you know, the minions beneath her can't figure out how to get the info to her? Unacceptable. So much in that audit was unacceptable. The fact that I had to yell out to get testimony on this, which is called a report, which shouldn't be referred to as a report, is unacceptable. This is the kind of thing that Joe was talking about earlier, that Joe Walsh was talking about, where you have to bridge the gap between this lack of transparency, call for honesty, and bring the city, the city's people to the table to discuss these things. Absolutely unacceptable. Thank you again for allowing us testimony.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name's Mary Seip, and I'd like to echo everyone else's expression of thanks for allowing testimony. And what I'd also like to do is to ask all of you to perhaps try to persuade Mayor Wheeler to change his position on not allowing testimony on reports. I've been here many times where I've had information that I really think if I had been able to share it with you, you would have all been quite surprised, and that it would have been very beneficial for you to know. But because it was a report, I was unable to share that information. What I want to speak about is the short-term rentals. I am pretty certain that the building that Commissioner Udaly referred to, that is renting out 54 units, is the building across the street from where I live.
It's not in the Pearl, but...
It's not? Okay. Well, I can tell you that the building across the street from where I live is doing exactly the same thing.
Great.
And it's... there's a number of things about it that really alarm me. One is that there's actually two buildings across the street from where I live that are using Airbnb, and it is like living across the street from two high-rise hotels. And one of the big concerns about it is that what this is doing is that it is allowing them to offset the problem that they're having in that they built almost 800 units of luxury homes in this six blocks area in a 3-year period that they can't rent. Now, because they can use Airbnb, the natural progression of things is not allowing that situation to drive the rents down in the neighborhood. And we definitely need to do something about this. I also was doing some research, and my conclusion when I did this research was it appears to me that these regulations about the short-term rentals may only apply to residential zones and not to mixed-use zones. I may be wrong about that, but that was the conclusion that I was getting, which tells me then there's no regulation in the Pearl District because it's a mixed-use zone, and that all of these apartment buildings could be doing what the buildings in my neighborhood are doing. So what I would like to say is if that is the case, red flag, that needs to be addressed in the scope of what you regulate with the short-term rentals. So, and again, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Joe.
Yeah, were there two other people that wanted to speak also? You can come up to the table. We got two seats available. Yeah. Okay, so we'll take these two and then we'll take you. And that'll complete the testimony.
Are we ready?
Yeah, ready.
Good morning. My name is Joe Wallace. I represent Individuals for Justice. And again, I would like to echo our thanks for allowing us to speak. I realize it is an option call by the presiding official or the president of the council. Chloe, if you leave, we have to adjourn. One of the things that I thought about when the presentation from the auditors was that this all began as an idea that someone had a house and there were some vacant rooms and they decided to rent them out. Seems like a reasonable idea for everybody. People coming to town could get cheap rates. They wouldn't have to pay the going rate at the hotels. And they couldn't afford them anyway, so they stayed with people in-house, kind of like couch serving, except they had a room. And then the city said, whoa, what is going on here? We could make some money on this. So the city wants to permit it. It seems to me that that's big government. You know, it's overbearing government. And it seems to me that we have better ways of doing it. Why couldn't we ask the organizations that pop up to legislate themselves, you know, and work with them? What we do is we attempt something and it doesn't work, and then we just get really nasty, and we start with a $1,000 fine, a $5,000 fine. Why don't we continue working with these groups and say, you know, we're worried about these items, you know, the cleanliness and all these things, and work that out. People are usually reasonable, I think, and they're fighting you. They don't want to pay for permits. They don't want the extra expenses. So, you know, that's what crossed my mind. It seems like big government, that someone came out with a good idea, and government said, we can make a buck over here. And this is almost like you guys permitting apartment buildings with no off-street parking and then building parking garages and then owning them and making money off them or subcontracting to them. See what I'm saying? Solutions that you come up with really suck. They really do. And I don't understand that. You have really bright people in your committees. I've been around them. So why don't you do really good stuff? I don't know. There's something wrong here. There's a message being missed by somebody. Thank you.
Thank you.
And by the way, we do fully endorse Dan's presentation. How you doing?
Okay, who's next? Mr. Johnson, you're next.
Thank you, President Saltzman and fellow commissioners. I think that Joe Walsh has been at the end. For your practical concerns and for the practical concerns of all the citizens listening, that is probably the best use of our time, is to go back and review the testimony of Dan Saltzman. But that shouldn't necessarily be the most useful part of this whole 30-minute, in excess of 30-minute song and dance. Those of us who are here in chambers have a lot of paperwork that we can review. But people who are at home looking at the agenda, when they click on 962, they just get a little bit of two-page PDF. None of this material is available. For public officials that are supposedly campaigning on transparency and accountability, there's so much room for improvement that I hope that you'll look at ways to, you know, it's complicated because there are little silos and turf, no turf wars between bureaus or people in Portland ever, and I'm sure never that happens. But some things can happen quickly. Within the past few months, somebody came and said, you know, when portland.oregon/gov.smart is typed into the computer, it shouldn't go to just be about parking. And that was changed pretty easily and pretty quickly. So I'm sure that if the information technology people talk with the clerk and talk with the auditor, you can improve delivering all this information, this copy of a June 12th joint letter from the mayor and the chief of police to the, or excuse me, yeah, from the mayor and the chief of the police to the auditor. There is an e-file system, but it should be just linked as part of this agenda item. We shouldn't be expecting citizens to become masters of the e-files, e-gov document system. So later on, people will probably make an outtake, a separate video file to put on Facebook and Twitter and all that, and share with Notify PDX Twitter so that you can review Mr. Saltzman's testimony about the hard work that's ahead of us to not have a paramilitary police organization, but to really live up to this idea of the PSEP committee and have community-engaged policing where every community, every neighborhood feels safely and fairly engaged with the police, and it doesn't become such a dramatic thing when the chief of police goes on the Lars Larson show to do her public engagement and talks about how whiny the citizens are and how thrilled she is that they got smashed down within weeks of having a grenade, videos all over the internet where you can see Portland police officers not using 5 degrees of elevation, not using 15 degrees of elevation, but just shooting things into the back of people's head. Thank you.
Mr. Johnson, the auditor obviously had to leave. She is an independently elected city official, so I would suggest you contact her with your suggestion about linking the reports, because they are really good reports, I agree.
They are there. Excuse me. They are there.
On the
they
page.
Are linked.
They're there.
Okay, yeah. Thank you for clarifying. Maybe it's my technology error, but when I just clicked on the 962, I just got two pages of PDF. But oh, it's, sometimes there's a separate breakout underneath.
Thank you, Carla. It says all audits can be viewed on the audit services webpage, and it has a link to the audits.
Okay.
That's they're all available on their website.
Excellent. Thank you for more interjections from Carla would make this a much better program.
I think we all agree.
I agree.
On that.
Sir, do you want to come up to the table too? We have a chair now. Go ahead, Mr. Lightning.
Yes, my name is Lightning. I represent Lightning Super Creativity Disruptor Attack Dog. One of the concerns I have on this short-term rentals from these the apps or the platforms themselves is that when we think of technology and the advance of technology, these companies need to also show a social responsibility to our city. And they need to understand is that if you do not begin to provide the proper data and to show the true effects which they've done in San Francisco on these short-term rentals, on the housing for all the people in the city to utilize, and it's being limited because of this platform, you are showing a disservice to the city and the people of the city. And let me make an example or show you an example to look at. It's the same thing on Uber and Lyft. When I was speaking against them to have a cap put into place and then see what the market does, this can get out of control if you do not show social responsibility to the people of this city and to provide the proper data and make sure the proper permits are utilized. It is your responsibility as a technology company, as a platform provider, to assist all the people in this city, and you need to step up and start doing that, because this can get out of control very fast and literally create homelessness. And we can decrease homelessness if we have the proper data provided. Now, issue number two on police training, I want more training on de-escalation. I want more training on the profanity issue. And these officers know what profanity is and what it isn't. And we need to have an understanding. Let's just tone it down. Do your job in a professional manner. And a lot of people in this city will begin to respect you. You use profanity against our people in this city. We're not going to respect you for that. Now, issue number three on the stormwater fees. I really think we're missing the mark on this. A lot more people should be in this. I'm not quite sure how you came up with the discount rate on that, but we're obviously missing the mark on how many people are in that program. It does need to be increased in some manner, whether it's more efficient marketing, more face-to-face, or knocking on the doors, but they need to get into these programs. Thank you.
Thank you. Sir, if you could just give us your name, and you have 3 minutes.
Okay. My name is Richard Hernandez. My first item I'd like to talk about is gentrification. Folks, a lot of people of color in, you know, have experienced, okay, they talk about at past rallies why America was never great. These gentrification policies follow the, you know, I'm white, and of course I've had some benefits, but people of color, you know, and you ask them why, have, except for a few, have never been able to experience this full, you know, what America's found has been founded on basis, you know, because of a color, and people from the times of Martin Luther King, and every time a black person is shot and killed by police, it stirs up hatred, you know, as being put down, as being put down. Continues put down by the system that enslaved them over 300 some odd years ago, and the policy of neighborhoods still goes in policy of, instead of improving these neighborhoods for people of color and minorities and gender, it's being improved so a bunch of rich white people can have all that property. And so what policies are being played? Nothing. And so, you know, here's my prediction. So when these white nationalists come back here, you know, I probably think flashbangs are going to be used again because they're going to protect them, because there's a lot of people who think that they think they're right and they want people of immigrants to be pushed down. And these white nationalists are not going